Afternoon, Your Honors. Jessica Zeldin from Rosenthal, Monheit & Gottes. On behalf of the appellant, Joel Grover, I rise today to introduce my co-counsel. With me at counsel table is Lawrence Eagle and Jeffrey Squire. Mr. Squire, will be making today's argument on behalf of the appellants.
Welcome to the court.
You
may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Justices. Jacobson, Ridgely. The Court of Chancery was correct when it held that plaintiff pled sufficient facts to show that the 2009 sale transaction was unfair. The Court of Chancery was also correct when it held the complaint pled sufficient facts to show that defendants selected special approval in bad faith because they had concluded they couldn't satisfy any of the other alternative methods to approve a conflicted transaction. In particular, the general partner concluded that the transaction was not fair, but selected a special approval to benefit the controller of the general partnership, Duncan. This appeal presents two principal issues. First, does special approval foreclose all judicial inquiry about a partnership's conflicted transactions, even when the determination to select special approval and to take that action is not done in good faith? And by not done in good faith, I mean that the determination was made and the act was taken to elevate the interests of someone other than the partnership above the interests of the partnership. The Court of Chancery correctly held that special approval must be selected and done in good faith. The defendants argue the opposite. The special approval drops the curtain, show's over, we all go home because there's nothing else to decide. And that's regardless of whether special approval is selected in bad faith. As to that first principle issue, defendants are incorrect. But before I'll get to the reasons for that.
Before you get on there, there's a distinction, and I don't know, you know, whether you're making it or not, between selecting special approval as one of the, four criteria, or having selected it, having the special approval process not be carried out in good faith. And I'm not sure what the argument is here.
I'm not sure that's an important distinction in this case, but I base it on the Limited Partnership Agreement, Section 7.9b, which says that all acts, except where there's another express standard, have to be, the determination has to be made and the act taken in good faith. So. But here, I'm not sure that distinction is important. The second principal issue on the appeal is whether defendants, to enjoy a conclusive presumption of good faith under Section 7.10b, need only have an expert's opinion, but must they also show they relied on that opinion. So before addressing these two principal issues, I want to put them in context of the transactions. The complaint primarily considers two transactions: the 2009 sale of TEPCO GP by EPE to Enterprise for about $100 million, together with the hope or projection of the same cash flow, when EPE had purchased the TEPCO GP from Duncan about 2 years before for $1.1 billion, and the 2010 merger of EPE into Enterprise without giving any value to two derivative claims asserted at the time against Duncan and his affiliates. The Court of Chancery held that sufficient facts were pledged to show their principal purpose of both the 2009 and 2010 transactions was to extinguish claims that had been asserted against Duncan and his affiliates. That is, a principal purpose of both of the transactions was to benefit Duncan. As the court below wrote, this is page 32 from the slip opinion, according to the complaint, Enterprise Products GP decided that the 2009 sale benefited its controller, that was Duncan, and then Enterprise Products GP found a way to use one of Section 7.9A standards to prevent this court from reviewing it. That is bad faith. The 2009 transaction was done to benefit Duncan by resolving claims against him and his affiliates. Those are the claims which are discussed in detail in the decision in Brinkerhoff versus TEPCO. After I return to the two principal issues, special approval and reliance on experts, if time permits, I'm going to talk about how those relate to the two transactions. Returning to the first principal issue, special approval. As the Court of Chancery held, and we contend, special approval is constrained by good faith defendants say otherwise, but defendants are incorrect for five reasons. First, all the decisions I'm aware of in the Court of Chancery have disagreed with the defendant's interpretation, and none support it. Second, the EPE Limited Partnership Agreement, I'll refer to that as the LPA, provides four alternative methods to resolve conflicts of interest, one of which is special approval. But Section 7.9A gives no standard, and certainly no express standard, for special approval. Section 0.79A does not say the special approval can be taken not in good faith, or at defendant's sole discretion, or need not be taken in good faith.
So that's the gap that the implied covenant fills?
If one relies on the implied covenant, yes.
Well, that was going to be my question. You keep using the term good faith. Do you mean that in a good faith is the method of carrying out fiduciary duties of loyalty and care, or when you say good faith, do you mean the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing?
I mean both. I think it can be both. I do think that the partnership agreement, and I'll get to that next, does provide that these acts have to be done in good faith. Explicitly, it says that. So I'm not sure we have to get to the implied covenant, but I think the implied covenant, as Justice Richley said, fills the gap as to what standard should be used to select and then follow up through on special approval.
But you may get some pushback on the theory that the good faith that's part of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, which is a contractual concept, is the equivalent of fiduciary duties understanding of the concept of good faith in another context. That's why we're looking for which distinction, if any, you're making. It would be rather difficult to make the case in Delaware that the good faith of both is exactly the same.
Well, I understand the limitations on the implied covenant, Your Honor. I think I can show that the partnership agreement requires these acts to be selected and then taken in good faith. So
the answer is it's the fiduciary duty good faith you're talking about.
Well, the partnership agreement actually makes a distinction. We don't know if it's belt or suspenders or otherwise. But when it says in four instances that the general partner and its affiliates need not act with any fiduciary duty, and then it says, nor act in good faith. So I think good faith is a more central concept than general fiduciary duty. I think good faith means you can't take someone else's interests above those in the partnership. Section 7.9 is my third reason that defendants are incorrect. Section 7.9B of the EPE-LPA says that special approval must be selected and the act taken in good faith. The Court of Chancery, Your Honor, knows, referred to, all Your Honors, referred to the implied covenant, but then said the implied covenant only applies to the general partner and then absolved the general partner under Section 7.10B. However, Section 0.79B, Section 7.9B of the EPE-LPA, says the general partner and its affiliates must perform all acts in good faith unless the LPA provides another express standard. And for instance, as I mentioned, the LPA does say the general partners and affiliates can do these acts without fiduciary duties and also need not do them in good faith. But special approval is not included among those four acts. So my point is that the drafters of the LPA knew how to provide for another express standard, not in good faith, but they did not provide another express standard for special approval. The fourth reason defendants are incorrect is that special approval is not an express standard. The LPA does not define, in its many defined terms, express standard. Special approval is an act, a method to approve conflicted transactions under Section 7.9A. Under 7.9B, standards of conduct, the determination to select the act of special approval needs to be done and the act taken in good faith. Special approval is a method, not a standard. It's no more a standard than a vote or a resolution. It's a standard. And the fifth reason that special approval need be done in good faith is that Delaware law does not allow a fiduciary, a controlling party, or general partner, to act in bad faith by implication. Delaware law encourages freedom of contract. The general partner drafts the LPA, and the Delaware law permits the general partner very great discretion in what it wants to put in, maybe complete discretion. It can restrict fiduciary duties. It can even eliminate fiduciary duties. However, because the general partner drafts...
Let me stop you there, because sure. There seems to be a debate in the briefs, and it was also addressed by the Court of Chancery, as to whether this particular limited partnership agreement eliminated fiduciary duties or merely restricted or modified them. Is that what turns on that? Why does it matter?
I'm not sure that anything does, Your Honor. Justice Jacobs, here, whether we made an argument in our brief that there was a residual fiduciary duty,
right.
But I'm not arguing that today.
And if there is a residual fiduciary duty, what follows from that?
Well, then I think the act has to be taken like a fiduciary, which requires, I think, more be done, and it only be done in good faith. That's the way I would believe it. But we're resting. We make that argument. We're not withdrawing that argument. But I think in the limited time, I'm arguing the implied covenant and Section 7.9b. So Delaware law says that fiduciary duties can be even eliminated, but they have to be done so clearly and expressly. And the Chancellor wrote in Miller versus American Real Estate, to the extent that an agreement purports to insulate a general partner from liability, even for acts of bad faith towards the partnership, it should do so in the most painstakingly clear terms. So the general partner could have drafted the LPA to say the act of special approval need not be taken in good faith. Defendant's position is that, well, the general partner can take the act of special approval in bad faith, but defendant's argument rests on the assumption that bad faith here can be an implied standard. I don't believe that's correct. The default standard under Section 7.9b is for good faith, and there's no implied right to act in bad faith. So those are the five reasons that defendants are incorrect when they argue that special approval is not restricted by good faith. The second issue is reliance under Section 7.10b. The Court of Chancery found that we had alleged facts to show that defendants had selected special approval because they determined they couldn't satisfy any of the other criteria, the other methods, to approve a conflicted transaction. And in particular, defendants knew that they could not show that one of those alternative methods, that the transaction was fair and reasonable, they couldn't satisfy that. So
your argument is that that if this reliance clause, Section 710, is to be enforceable, then we would have to read into it, that is into the word reliance, reasonable and good faith?
Yes, I believe so. Yes.
Okay. And the source of that argument is what?
Well, the source would be section, maybe the implied covenant, which doesn't have a standard, since there's no standard given for the reliance, and also Section 7.9b, which says that anytime you make a determination, such as to get an expert's approval.
Is there a source in the LLC statute itself?
About the standards for reliance?
Yes.
Not that, that
is,
I'm...
If it's important to your case that this conclusive presumption provision in Section 710 not bar judicial inquiry.
Yes.
In order for that result to occur, we would have to read into the word rely or reliance as it's used in Section 710, the modifiers reasonable and good faith. All I'm asking is, okay, and where do we get that from?
Well, I think we get the good faith from the implied covenant since there's no standard of reliance. And we also, I think, get it from 7.9b, which says every act, like reliance on an expert's opinion, has to be done in good faith. So I'm not sure about the reasonableness, but the good faith, I think.
Could the drafters have modified or curtailed to some extent the implied covenant in Section 7.2?
I don't believe that was the intention. They don't say, for example, that I think if they wanted to say reliance need not be in good faith, they'd have to write that into the partnership agreement so investors would see what they were getting into. But they didn't do that.
Okay, so basically the word reliance is already preloaded with the concepts of good faith and reasonableness, and if they're going to be taken out, they would have to be taken out clearly and explicitly, like fiduciary, like the modification of fiduciary duties.
Certainly good faith. But here I think the facts go beyond that, because here the Vice Chancellor...
Well, I'm not asking about facts. I'm asking about the law.
Okay. I believe that the reliance has to be in good faith. I would also believe it has to be reasonable, but I can't give you a source for that right now. But if you don't mind, I'm going to go to the facts quickly. That the Vice Chancellor found that the general partner had concluded the transaction was not fair. So I don't think the general partner could rely, and certainly not rely in good faith, on a opinion that was exactly the opposite to its own conclusion, and particularly this opinion, which didn't even decline to address the fairness of the transaction that we're challenging, the sale of the TEPCO GP. I'm limited my time, and I will save other remarks for rebuttal. Thank you.
May I please the court? Again, I'm Carl Stern. On behalf of appellees, I want to start with the notion that this 7.9B is a catch-all for a duty of good faith. 7.9B specifically talks about the duty under the contract unless another express standard is provided for in this agreement. And it's our position that there is another express standard provided for in the agreement with respect to conflicted transactions. And that standard is, it's basically two substantive standards and two procedural standards. The substantive standards are in, and they're both, they're all in 7.9A. The substantive standard is that a conflicted transaction shall be permitted and deemed approved by all partners and shall not constitute a breach of this agreement or of any agreement contemplated herein or therein, et cetera, if the resolution or course of action in respect of such conflict of interest is fair and reasonable to the partnership, or on terms no less favorable to the partnership than those generally being provided to or available from unrelated third parties. So those are substantive standards. It is also deemed approved by all partners and not a breach of this agreement if it is approved by special approval or approved by the vote of a majority of units excluding units owned by the general partner or its affiliates. So what you have, and it makes logical sense, either the general partner is put to the test of proving substantively that the substantive standards have been complied with, or the general partner is put to the proof of showing that it complied with a procedural process that makes sense, because whether it's a vote of the partners or it's approval by special approval of the Committee of Independent Directors, you're taking the conflicted party out of the decision process as far as whether or not it is fair and reasonable. What the plaintiffs have done in this case is say, all right, we can undermine or take away your right to rely on special approval by saying you didn't think or you can't prove the substantive standard.
Well, let's assume, and I don't know that there's any dispute about this, that the persons who approved the transactions that are at issue here were non-conflicted. You know, they were qualified. Is it your position that under this partnership agreement, those persons could have approved the transaction not in good faith?
It is my position that you would then have to look to the duty of good faith and fair dealing and look at all the laws surrounding the duty of good faith and fair dealing, look at NMIC, and see what is required to establish a breach of a duty of good faith and fair dealing. And they
were they required under the implied covenant or the duty to perform in good faith to conduct the special approval process in good faith?
Under, as I understand that duty, under the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, which would require a showing.
I'm sorry, is the answer yes or no?
I believe, yeah, it's yes.
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 But in order for us to uphold the Vice Chancellor's determination, we have to read into that Section 710B, correct? That is the section that creates a conclusive presumption that there was good faith on the part of the deciders if they relied, in this case, on the opinion of an investment banker who had the expertise to render that opinion. Is that correct?
I do not think it's necessary if there is an implied duty of good faith and fair dealing. What I'm asking is,
isn't it essential to your position? First of all, isn't the application to this transaction, that is this decision-making process, of Section 710B essential?
Yes, it is.
All right. And is it correct that Section 710B creates a conclusive presumption that the independent deciders acted in good faith because they relied on the Morgan Stanley opinion, fairness opinion?
Yes.
Is it correct or not that Section 710B does not require that that reliance be either reasonable or in good faith?
That's correct.
What is correct?
I'm sorry, I missed the question. I thought you were asking me.
Section 10B require that the reliance be in good faith.
It does not expressly require that the reliance be in good faith.
Does it impliedly require it?
I do not think it does. Okay. I do not think it puts us to the test. I think it creates a conclusive presumption. And I think if we were going to get into the type, I'm sorry, I keep steering it back to the NMIC decision, because I think when I read the NMIC decision and you look at the distinction here between what I see as a process and what I see as a substantive standard, and at a pleading stage,
before you get into that, would it have been statutorily permissible to write into this partnership agreement a clause that said where there is a conflict transaction and a special approval process is used, that approval process need not be conducted in good faith, that is, the reliance need not be reasonable or in good faith? Or to put it differently, that the implied covenant of good faith shall not apply in these circumstances. Can you write that into a partnership agreement?
I believe you can write that into a partnership agreement. I do not think that's necessary for us to prevail on this appeal.
Doesn't the statute make the implied covenant of good faith sacrosanct territory that cannot be tinkered with by contract?
Yes.
And aren't you tinkering with it here under a different guise in Section 710?
I understand where the court's going, and I focus on what these plaintiffs have alleged in this case, and whatever the limits may be, they haven't come close, because they started out with inflammatory allegations about how this was a $1.1 billion transaction.
Well, what they have alleged, and just so, and I'm apologize for interrupting you, but I
sure.
Just want to make sure we have the issues clearly stated, is that, you know, even under Section 710B, any reliance on an investment banker's fairness opinion has to be in good faith and may be reasonable as well. I gather your position is no, it does not have to be.
I would say in this case it was.
No, it does not have to be. That is under Section 710. Is that right?
Under Section 710.
Okay.
But our primary position is that they, to the extent that they've alleged that that the committee did not rely in good faith, it's a conclusory allegation. It is they asked the court to infer that we didn't rely based on complaints about the specific transaction. They started out with this was such a wildly awful transaction that no one in their right mind could have approved it or relied on an expert who said it was fair and reasonable. But at the same time, they admitted that it was a cash-neutral transaction, that we're not dealing with a situation where a $1.1 million asset or a $700 million asset, whichever number you want to take, was sold for consideration of $100 million.
But if they properly allege that the approving special committee did not rely on the Morgan Stanley opinion in good faith or reasonably, your response would have to be, it doesn't matter. Correct?
Yes.
And that would be because 7.9A says you don't have to. If you follow the special approval, the transaction with special approval, then good faith doesn't apply.
Right.
I'm terribly confused that in the course of the discussion from the beginning, we've conflated good faith and the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. What is the reference in 7.10 dealing with other than the concept of good faith in under Delaware law, which is the way in which one carries out the duty of loyalty or care, fiduciary duties that can be modified by an agreement? It's not referring to the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. But I'm hearing comments that conflate the two as if it's the same doctrine.
Well, maybe what I have been focused on is the adequacy of their pleadings.
Well, what precisely did the appellant plead that suggests a breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing with the assumption that that cannot be written out of any limited partnership or LLC contract in this state?
I think they have pled nothing that would support an inference of a breach of a good faith, implied duty of good faith and fair dealing.
So your position would be what they're talking about is the good faith concept that derives from fiduciary duties.
Yes.
And that can be altered.
Yes.
By the terms of a contract in order to satisfy the legislature's desire that Delaware be known as a state where maximization of freedom of contract prevails, correct?
Yes, correct. And I'm afraid I've gotten down in the weeds on the question of whether or not they've adequately pled.
That the Chief Justice's question prompts me to ask you the same question I asked your friend on the other side, and that is that there's a debate going on the issue of whether or not the limited partnership agreement here eliminates fiduciary duties or merely modifies and restricts them. And my question was, does it really matter? The answer I got from your honorable opponent was not. Doesn't really matter. Is that your view or not?
I believe it does eliminate them.
Does it matter if you if we
not with respect to the specific not
modified as opposed to eliminated?
No, because we're relying on a very specific authorization under the agreement.
Okay.
On
one other question, related. The affiliates that control the partnership. Through the GP, are they parties to the limited partnership agreement?
They are not parties to the limited partnership agreement.
All right. So if they're not parties to the partnership agreement, then they have no right to claim the benefits under the, that agreement, correct?
I believe that's incorrect.
And if the agreement eliminates or modifies fiduciary duties, that may be the case. That is, that, that benefit may be one that can be enjoyed by the general partner, but not by the entities or people that control the general partner who are not signatories to the agreement. Is that correct?
No, that's not correct. And maybe I misunderstood your prior question.
How could they not? How could it not be correct? They're not parties to the agreement. They don't have the burdens under that agreement. So how can they get the benefits? And specifically, how can they get the benefits of being freed up from fiduciary duties when they haven't signed on to the agreement?
The limited partners signed on to the agreement.
Yes.
As members of this limited partnership, there are duties that, absent any contractual standard, would be applied with respect to the relationship, fiduciary duties. And this contract specifically says, limited partners, you're not entitled to rely on those duties. And we're the beneficiaries.
With respect to whom?
With respect to any affiliate that may otherwise owe fiduciary duties.
So basically it's a waiver of their right to bring fiduciary duty claims against any of those non-parties. That is, not just the general partner, but whoever controls the general partner?
Yes.
That wasn't what was communicated in the offering, the SEC filing, was it? I mean, was that the understanding to the public in terms of what rights they would receive when they invested in this security?
I believe so. I mean, we can look at that specific language, and we can look at the limited partnership agreement that was made part of that, which explained in detail what the fiduciary duties of the controlling affiliates would be.
Okay.
I want to just very briefly, just a couple of clarifications. There was no finding that the 2009 transaction was entered in order to avoid claims. The plaintiff has conflated the Brinkerhoff case, which is completely different, and a reading of the facts of that case and the parties involved and the claims involved will show that although there was a finding that at the LP level, the transaction was influenced by pending claims against the LP, the TEPCO LP, that was not a consideration. Those were not claims that were held by the EPE shareholders who are plaintiffs in this case and are just unrelated. Focusing on what they pled, as I read Nimick and the other cases dealing with the implied duty of good faith and fair dealing, they are required to allege particularized facts to sustain a cause of action for a breach of that duty. And they just haven't done that here. I mean, they quibble about the transaction, aspects of the transaction, but they have not alleged the types of facts that the courts have held would be required. In addition, again, focusing on the procedure, one of the things that they challenge in their briefing is, well, what, there's got to be something that the implied duty of good faith and fair dealing would prohibit the defendants from doing in connection with the special approval process. And they raise the hypothetical of a bribing the financial advisor. It's our position that they would have to show something that interfered with the special approval process. I mean, the expectation of the parties is you have a process.
Well, why wouldn't acting in bad faith interfere with the special approval process?
Well, the question is what is, I mean, bad faith is just a general standard applied to this situation. When this court talked in Nivek about the implied duty of good faith and fair dealing. It talked about depriving the parties of the fruits of the contract. Here, either we meet the substantive standard or we go through the process. And if you bribe the financial advisors, I think that would breach a duty because you are interfering with the expectations the parties had about this process, that you were submitting this to independent directors, and that those directors are entitled to rely on financial advisors, qualified financial advisors.
So there is a gap in 7.9A into which the implied covenant fits?
If you were going to try to come up with the outer limits, I do not see how bribing that this contract immunizes our directors from accepting bribes or bribing financial advisors, something like that. That's my point.
Well, why doesn't that gap include acting in bad faith?
We are presumed to act in good faith when we rely on a financial advisor that's qualified. To render the opinion.
Assumptions cannot be overcome by facts?
At the pleading, they are pleading a claim that is putting us to proof on a substantive standard. Our agreement says that we don't have to be put to proof on that if we follow a process and rely on financial advisors, independent qualified financial advisors, and that's what happened here. The partners agreed that if we use that process, then we're not subject to challenge, especially with pleadings of the type that we have here where they're quibbling about the details of the transaction.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon again, Your Honor. Regarding whether the purpose of the 2009 transaction was to extinguish claims, what I read from the Vice Chancellor's opinion, he concluded that the 2009 sale benefited EPE's controller. And the reason for that, why did it benefit EPE's controller? Because it was designed as part of the whole transaction where TEPCO, TEPCO had a derivative claim against Duncan, and that was being resolved by this merger. In fact, the defendant said in their brief that, well, once the LP merger was done, then the GP had to merge. So the purpose of the 2009 and the 2010 transaction was to benefit Duncan by eliminating derivative claims against him. I think we all agree that the implied covenant can't be written out of an agreement. Now, the issue then is, Justice Steele said, Delaware law encourages freedom of contract, encourages partnerships to modify duties, certainly doesn't prevent them from doing so. But that cuts both ways. The general partner can restrict fiduciary duties, but it has to tell investors what it's doing. And if it restricts the duty of good faith, I believe Delaware law says the general partner just needs to do that clearly. It can't have reliance.
But when you say the duty of good faith, there is no independent duty of good faith in Delaware. The
right.
Requirement under common law fiduciary duties, the duty of loyalty and care, which are the two fiduciary duties, must be carried out in good faith. Your particularized pleading has to tell us exactly what happened here that caused us to believe there's a breach of duty of loyalty because the duty wasn't carried out in good faith.
I'll try to get to that. But I think if Your Honor's read 7.9B and read the entire partnership agreement, says that the actions and the determinations need to be taken in good faith. That's what people read when they invest in this. The general partner could have explicitly said...
Which good faith? Good faith as within the purview of fiduciary duty jurisprudence or good faith within the purview of implied covenant jurisprudence?
Well,
assuming there's a difference.
I'm not sure there is a difference. What I've reduced it to, I believe, the bottom good faith is not doing something where you advance the interests of someone else over the interests of the partnership agreement. I think that's what 7.9b requires. I mean, the defendants, the general partner could have said, we can rely on an expert's opinion, not in good faith. They could have written that into the agreement, but it did not.
You may have answered some question, but not the one I asked you.
I'm sorry.
The question is, good faith, when you're, you know, alleging breach of the duty to act in good faith, are you referring to good faith as that term is used in fiduciary duty law, or are you using it in as that term is used in implied covenant
law? I'll try to answer it better. I believe I'm using it as it's used in the implied covenant, but I also believe it's not implied, it's explicit in the partnership agreement. And that's why I would answer. Now, there may be a difference in that the vice chancellor held that the implied covenant only applied to the general partner, but 7.9b applies to the general partner and its affiliates. I argued opening that there was no implied right to act in bad faith, and I don't think that was addressed by the defendants.
You're quite right that the limited partnership agreement makes the duty to act in good faith express, not implied. Does that in any way change the content of the duty?
No, I don't think it does. I don't think it does.
All right, thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel, we'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.
Please rise.